Sādhu nopānse bhagavā sucira parinibbotopi pācimācchanatānukha pamānasa ime sakkhāre dukkhatthapannakalabhute patikkhannātu amhakkhaṃ dikkhavataṃ hitāya sukhāya arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi. Suvākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho saṅghaṃ namāmi. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Itipiso bhagavā arahaṃ sammāsambuddho viccācharana-sampanno sukkhato lokavidu anuttaro purisa-dhammasāratthi sattha deva manussanaṃ buddho bhagavā tamahaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhipūjayāmi. Tamahaṃ bhagavantaṃ sirasā namāmi. Suvākato bhagavata dhammo sanditthikho akkhalikho ehi bhāṣikho oppanayikho pacchataṃ vedittāpo viññuhi. Tamahaṃ dhammaṃ abhipūjayāmi. Tamahaṃ dhammaṃ sirasā namāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho ujjhapatipanno bhagavato savakasangho yāya patipanno bhagavato savakasangho samīci patipanno bhagavato savakasangho yādhitāṃ cattāri purisāyugāni ātta purisa pugala esa bhagavato savakasangho ahuneyo ahuneyo dakhineyo anjalikaraniyo anuttaraṃ punyaketaṃ lokasā. มหันสังฆังอภิปุจยามิธัมมหันสังฆังสิวาสานะมัง
questions. can you explain right view and also right livelihood? Yes, I can. I think I already did that the first major talk. Right view is understanding anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three characteristics. It is understanding the Four Noble Truths, which is a part of the suffering, the dukkha, and it's understanding that suffering is. And what is suffering? Is being separated from what you want. So where do you want to be right now? If you're not there, welcome to suffering. Or being associated with what you don't want. That's called suffering. So how can you solve the problem of suffering? Where you are, make that where you want to be. So if you want to be here, you're not separated from where you want to be. The end of suffering. I'll repeat this one. One person. This is where I am in my spiritual life and my material life. This is now where I should be. And I keep just getting up and then I fall down again. I know I can get up to jhanas, enlightenment, really, you know, just have lots of monasteries all paid off. But it's all down here and I just get up a little bit and I go down again. So, how do you solve that? This is where you are, this is where you want to be. Move where you want to be to where you are. Problem solved. Sometimes people don't want the simple solutions. They want it complicated. They want to sort of, you know, just want to get some experiences. Oh, forget it. Just be where you are and happy to be here. Then you're free. And then, second noble truth, wanting causes suffering. Third noble truth, let go of wanting, end of suffering. And fourth, how do you do that? Eightfold Path. That's right view, and right intention. I've made a lot about that already. It's not right intention. It is right motivation. Oh no, we've got right view and also right livelihood. Right livelihood is just where we try and have some means of existence where we don't create harm to others. However, whatever you do in this life, you create some little bit of harm. So we try and minimize the harm which we do in life. And that means that it's called right livelihood. So it's right livelihood, it's just not really defined. It is just livelihood, making a living, not at the expense of others. If you could do that. Dear Ajahn, I've been conditioned and taught since young to obey elders or people of seniority, and not question them. Hence, when I grow up, I always have this reservation or fear of speaking up or talking to people of seniority. How do I overcome this conditioning? So I am senior. I'm getting old now. So I hereby command you not to fear speaking up to others, especially to elderly. So obey what I say. Or just to have fun with people. Sometimes I tell my monks, you must disobey me. And then I think about it. And I think, hang on, how can I get out of that one? Because if they do disobey me, then they're obeying my orders. And if they do obey me, they're not disobeying me, so they're disobeying me again. So whatever they do, that command means they have to disobey me. They can't do it right, or maybe they're obeying me and they sort of get so confused. It's like one of those Zen koans. But my favourite one, which is a bit not very nice, but anyway, it made me laugh, about the master's advice to his student. And the student asked, Master, give me some advice, something practical for life. And the master thought and said, never argue with idiots. And the student thought, that's not compassionate. And the master said, yes, that's correct. When I am about to start to feel more joyful, I have the urge to sing silly songs, which I do softly in my room, knowing that breaks the eight precepts and apparently not an adequate deterrent. Do you have any tips to help me restrain myself when you sing silly songs? Now, you're confusing solitude with sillitude. And the last one is just the English version of that, which is sorry-tude. When you do something, you didn't do anything wrong, and somebody else bumps into you, but you say, oh, sorry. Why do people keep saying they're not really sorry, it's just a politeness? That's called sorry-tude. And when you say sing silly songs, that's called silly-tude. But the only thing you want to do is actually solitude, like being by yourself. Now that is much better than silly-tude or sorry-tude. Solitude. And when you have the urge to sing silly songs, which I do softly in my room, knowing this breaks the eight precepts, let me hear you singing. And when I hear your voice, no one in their right mind would call that singing. Certainly it's not entertainment. Can you please say other words? Just give yourself a break. After a while, you don't feel like singing silly songs. So you just let it all go. Can you please explain about dependent origination tomorrow morning? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. It really depends upon the conditions tomorrow. And that is now a bit explained to you. What do you mean by opening channels? How did they get blocked? Thanks with Metta. Or sometimes emotional problems, sometimes when we have emotional trauma, we just react by trying to safeguard ourselves, by blocking stuff, especially that people who maybe they don't know how to cry, and it gets, or they get anxious, they tighten up and it gets blocked and clogged. And that is like when they have those in the sewage systems in London, they have fat bergs, they have wet white bergs, they have all this other stuff which blocks up the sewage system. And that's just the same as us, that sometimes the sort of rubbish we allow ourselves to keep, emotional traumas and other sort of fears, that blocks us up. And the other ones, of course, is the physical traumas. Now, you've had sort of a big accident and things get broken and busted and blocked and twisted. And oh, that story of that woman who I was alerted to her, this is years ago, and she was really twisted around. So I said, you better have a look at that woman, look at her. And my goodness, she really was twisted. She was contorted. And it was like, you know, someone trying to torture her. And I was very concerned. And when I went to see her afterwards, she came out of meditation, took her aside and said, do you realize, you know, your posture? She said, what do you mean, my posture? My posture was perfect. I was so peaceful. I was so still having a great time. Ah, because you were so twisted in your posture. You never knew that you were twisting around. And I found out that she had a very severe car accident. And she was so lucky to actually come out alive. And obviously that they have done a lot of work to heal her body, but there was still stuff to be done. And just while she was meditating, totally let go of her body, it was really peaceful and calm and happy, and she didn't know what her body was up to when she was, you know, busy blissing out. And actually twisted around and just in a way so that the energy could go in the right place. And she felt really good afterwards. That's the only theory I have, but she certainly felt good afterwards. And anyway, in the Indian medical tradition, it's like winds going through your body, like channels of energy. In the Chinese tradition, the qi going through your body. And so that's a different way of looking at medicine. Why not? Is it true that Buddha said that if a person is not stingy, he'll be rich? If a person has no ill will, she'll be pretty. If a person asks questions, he, she'll be smart. How much not stinginess does it take so the person will be rich? Welcome to our Western world. So, this is in your next life. But it's true that how much of it works, how does karma work? It does seem to be that if you are really sort of stingy and you don't know how to make use of your money, what actually happens? It seems to me that it's like you don't deserve to have money in the next life. You just keep it for yourself and you just don't give any donations or don't help others. But then, for those people who are kind and who do give and help, it seems to be that, you know, they've almost like passed an exam, a test. The next lifetime, they'll have lots of money because they know how to make use of it. But it's not just for yourself or for your family, especially for your family and your kids. We always want to make sure our kids get a nice inheritance, but what happens when your kids get inheritance? They usually waste it. They don't work for it. They don't know the value of it. For many kids, they're not all like that, but some are. And so sometimes there's many rich people say, no, I'm not giving anything to my kids. You know, let them sort of work and earn it and just strive for it so they know the value of it. So it's not just money which is just there for them all the time. So anyway, because there's something to be said that, you know, reaching the goal, it's not really the point. It's actually just the path towards that goal, the journey. That is where a lot of the joy of the world is. If it's like for meditation and for enlightenment, it's a sort of different ball game. But that was where the two worst curses from the Middle East. And somebody once told me this, and I don't know if it were true or not, but I thought the second worst curse, you know, some of the curses people have in Australia or in England, I mean, just, you know, drop dead or just, you know, may something happen to you. But this curse, I thought, was really had a bit of class. It wasn't nice. If you didn't like someone in the Middle East, you would actually say, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. Now, why are you laughing? Because it's not a nice thing to say, but at least it's colourful. It's a good use of language. But the worst one was the one which was just most fascinating. And I thought, whoever said this, they knew just how to take people's happiness away. And that was, may you get everything you want as soon as you want it. Imagine that. As soon as you want, say, a cup of tea, it's just right there in front of you. As soon as you want money, it's just there. As soon as you want anything, it's just there. Material things, that is. There's no working for it, no striving for it, no effort. It's just as soon as you want it, it's there. It would drive you crazy. So this is one of the problems. We think, oh, I want this, I want that. There's actually a lot of time, it's a work towards that. Building a monastery. If I could just snap my fingers and the monastery appeared. Now that would be so amazing as we really worked for it and many people helped out to make it happen. Do you understand the difference there? It's in the reaching out for things that there is a certain amount of joy and happiness there. And of course it gives you the sense of achievement. So if you just give people everything, especially your children, is that really helping them? Maybe give them a little bit, but don't let them work for the rest. So stinginess, and also, here I always shoot myself in the foot here, if you give too much money in the donation boxes to Dharmasara, or to Bodhidharma, or to any. Is that good? Because what happens is the monks get lazy. I was going to say fat and lazy, but maybe I qualify for the first, but not lazy. I really work hard. Because sometimes you can see monks like that in other temples, even nuns. They live a life of luxury. There's something very wrong with that. So, you know, we try to make sure that we don't have one big donor. Just we have many people, $10 here, $5 there, and it all builds up. And the monastery temple is always needs things to be done, because we always need to encourage people to be generous. But if we had everything done, imagine that if I found this really billionaire, and they said, Ajahn Brahm, whatever you want, you can have it. So I would think I would have a butler, first of all, a personal butler. I mean, not a novice or an anagarika, but a real butler. You can't rely on that. They've just got one to meditate when I need a cup of tea or something. So you can never. Anyway, so a butler. And what else can I have? And room service. Sorry? Sauna. You've got a sauna. I'm English. I want a sort of a nice room, not a sauna. Yeah, it's really interesting. As soon as I think, what do I want? I just, you can't think about anything. You know, this is good enough. But anyway, sometimes it used to be the case in Thailand that the forest monasteries were so poor and so simple. And the city monasteries and the village monasteries, you know, that they were considered to be too lax. And now, just all the money and the funds goes to the forest monasteries. And so the standard of practice goes down. And sometimes I wondered if I was a monk ordaining, maybe go to one of the village monasteries. It's much tougher there. Interesting. Maybe not quite the same, but please don't spoil your monasteries by making them too luxurious. I've seen that happen. They get the tough monastery, not the tough, but the simple monasteries get respected and they get spoiled. Sometimes it's because they become very popular and too many people asking questions all day. You just, you know, you die young. Because I saw that with Ajahn Chah. That, you know, he never took any rest at all. And he was there all day talking to visitors and in the evening talking to the monks. Be careful. Is it true Buddha said, a person who's not stingy, they'll be rich? Yeah, if that's in this life, if you know how to use money, and it's not being stingy, it's just if you have some funds, then share it with people. And oh, look, when it comes to that sort of stuff, when I was lay Buddhist, I remember just going to the Buddhist society in Cambridge and the Cambridge Buddhist Club, and then most of the talks I'd fall asleep. They were just boring. There were these great teachers, and they would always teach the Four Noble Truths and stuff. No jokes. It was just... And I was just so disinterested. I was a Buddhist. I thought I should be there. But one of the talks I remembered, I was inspired. It wasn't much about Buddhism. It was a Tibetan nun who was running an orphanage in somewhere in Sikkim somewhere. And I thought, oh, that's really inspiring. It's like being compassionate. And so I went out the next morning, totally dumb, and got a sort of, I think, £20 out of my bank and got a bank draft for her orphanage. But anyway, it's about 2 or 3 weeks' food money for me. I couldn't afford it. But I decided I'm going to do it. May not sound much to you, but I went hungry. I didn't sort of not eat, but I certainly was, you know, a young man growing up, didn't have as much food as I needed, or wanted anyway. But that was one of the greatest donations. I always remember that, because it hurts. No, not really hurt, it's only physically, just, you know, I can make up for that later on. But I really like that. I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing that was. So that's, you know, we just do things that needs to be done. We help someone even though we're tired. We just give a person a ride, a lift, even though we're not going in that direction. That's a wonderful thing to do. That's really kindness. And that's the sort of generosity which I really, really sort of approve of. And if a person has no ill will, she'll be pretty. Beware of being pretty and being attractive. Because sometimes you meet sort of girls, you know, and they're just really, really attractive and they have a terrible time. Because all that people ever see is their attractiveness. They never go past that into their character, their kindness, into who they really are. And so that's why being pretty, I think that might be a curse if you're very attractive. And a person asks questions, then they'll be smart. It depends again on what type of questions. They've got a good inquiry in mind, but they're respectful. So anyway, that's pretty true. Ajahn, the word duty appears often in the ancient wisdom. What is one's duty? One's duty is the tax which one has to pay when one imports the wisdom and the kindness of the teacher. Tax, duty. Import duty. Oh, come on, I'm trying to make it up as I go along. What is your duty? You have duty to, say, parents. But the duty to parents is not just doing what they say. It's called, like, you give them extra weight. The word for respect in Pali is garu karoti. Garu means heavy. You make your parents, your teachers, advice heavier than the ordinary person. You give them extra weight. But just because they're the parents doesn't mean they're always right. If the Buddha had listened to his parents, there would not be a Buddha. So, but you still respect your parents, and you've got your duty to look after them as best you possibly can. But you have conflicting duties. I had a mother who was sick, but I had many people here I had a duty to as well. Fortunately, I had a brother who looked after my mum, and so I could do all my duties over here. So sometimes that, you know, we have our duties, we try and keep them as, you know, as practical as possible, being some who's not busy with duties. How can one not be busy with duties when there's so many things you have to do? And I think in that little handbook of Happy Every Day, or one of those books, I put in there a busy person who's not someone who has many things to perform. As a busy person is one who does too many things at the same time. They actually look busy. And I got that from an anecdote from a builder who was building this mansion from this very wealthy person in Sydney. And they said that the wealthy business person, money was not an object, he wanted the very top quality building. So when he went onto the building site to check the progress of his mansion, he saw this young 16 or 17 year old boy laying the bricks. And he said, look, I wanted experts, not young apprentices. And the builders said, come over here and have a look. And even though this was a really young bricklayer, he just had this incredible skill. He just weighed the bricks, bang, and the next one, bang. Everyone in place. He just had this rhythm to him, just a natural ability to lay bricks. And it was just so easy to do. So he did a lot of bricks every day, very good bricks, but without looking busy. And sometimes you find people like that at work. They don't appear busy. They get an enormous amount done. They've got a sort of rhythm to them. So that's why they just do one thing at a time, and you get a lot done. So that is how to do a lot, but without being busy. One complete duties prior to living monastically. Oh, that is just make sure that if, for example, you have kids. This is a young man, he said, I have a young daughter, but I really want to ordain. And is someone looking after your daughter? Not really. But look, if you abandon your daughter, you know, what sort of character are you? You'll abandon your duties in a monastery as well. So, you know, to be responsible, make sure that your daughter is well provided for. You know, she's maybe at an age where she can look after herself, and then you can become a monk or a nun. because, you know, there's a lot of responsibility for being a monk or a nun, a lot of duties, it's a lot of kindness and letting go. And it sounds very selfish that you just want to abandon others just so you can become a monk or a nun. Anyway, dear Ajahn, in many suttas, the stock phrase, "It's liberated, destroyed his birth, a holy life has been lived, etc., is stated. Does the "it" is liberated refer to the sixth sense only, or to the other mental components of existence as well, to all the mental components of existence?" It's one knows the liberation has happened. It's just a translation. Sometimes we read into translations what is not there. For example, that's a famous mistranslation in the Satipatthana Sutta to contemplate, be mindful of the body in the body. And feelings in feelings, mind in mind, it doesn't mean that. It's just the idiom. It is actually literally means, body awareness about the body. Body awareness is like one word. It's like it's a noun. You do dishwashing. Now, dishwashing is a word. You have a dishwasher. So what does a dishwasher wash? A dishwasher washes dishes, obviously. So in English, now it's redundant. You just do dishwashing. But in Pali, you do dishwashing of dishes. You do car cleaning of cars. You do, what else is there? You do a floor sweeping of floors. You bricklay bricks. So there's a redundancy of the words, an extra word there which comes up in many places in Pali. So when I read it for myself, hey, I understand this now. This was actually that Dr. A.K. Ward, he said, the best way to learn a foreign language, especially which is a dead language, only like the books, is read it and 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 read it until you get the way that the language works. So it doesn't mean that something's liberated, it just means liberation has happened. Otherwise, you say, if something's liberated, then there's something left. That's not left. When meditating today, my breath became more subtle and delightful, sometimes so subtle I could not clearly perceive it anymore. Woohoo! Occasionally, this bright golden light would flare up, but only last a few seconds. That's not bad. Every now and again, I would still have wandering thoughts, especially when I couldn't feel the breath. And that's okay. My mind felt light and happy. What would you advise at this stage? Nothing. Carry on. It's working, so just let it be. So it's just like, okay, Ajahn Brahm, I've managed to get my flight. I'm in the aircraft. The flight has taken off. What should I tell the captain to do? Just sit there and wait for it to happen. It's already taken off, and you go and tell the captain, okay, I'm in my seat, I fastened the seatbelt, and I'm now sort of, you've done the fastening the seatbelt, it's taken off, now not knocking the door, now what should I do next, captain? Just sit there and relax. And Buddha Air will take you the rest of the way. Since I was a kid, sometimes I have imagination, now I have imagination, visualization, e.g. having a partner in daily life. How can I remove this? You had imagination, now I have imagination. That's like that person who's, I'll tell you his name in a moment, but he always wanted to be a stand-up comedian when he was young. And when he told his teachers at career day, he said, when I grow up, I want to be a stand-up comedian. And his teachers and his friends and his parents laughed at him. Now he's a very famous comedian. No one's laughing at him now. And that was this fellow called Bob Monkhouse. He has some great one-liners. He said, when I die, this is death contemplation, when I die, I want to die in my sleep, like my grandfather. Not screaming and shouting, just like all the people in the bus he was driving at the time. That's not a very nice joke, but anyway. So you have imagination, wonderful. Now I have imagination, visualization, etc. Having a partner in daily life. Oh, come on. Just, you know, sometimes, you know, monks, they ordain and they want to do something in life and just become a great teacher, get enlightened and stuff. You know, sometimes after a few years, probably, you know, same with the nuns, you think, oh, maybe this is not for me. Maybe I should, you know, go out there in the world and get married and have kids and stuff. So what I usually do, you know, I actually sit them next to me, you know, when people come and tell me about their problems. They're sitting next to me and say, oh my goodness, my fantasies are not like the real life. And of course, sometimes we forget. And it's when there's like a separation, you're not so right in the cauldron of relationships, that sometimes we think that we could do better. That somehow or other that, you know, now we know how to work these things called relationships. And so they think that, you know, they can do it, but then they sit next to me and say, oh my goodness. And it was one of those monks years ago sitting next to me. That was where the two Thai sisters, they came up. I'll never forget this. It was just so funny, but so amazing. The elder sister said that, you know, they wanted counseling together. She had a husband causing her lots of trouble in life. And so that, you know, she was wanting to separate, get divorced, but, you know, should she? It was expensive. Is that the right thing to do? And they came in and ask a monk that question. What do I know? I've never been married. They'd asked me the question anyway. And so I gave her the answer the best I could. And then her younger sister, and she was the one, she could never find a partner in life. Well, she'd go out with a nice guy, maybe a month, 6 weeks, and then it all fall apart for some reason. And it just kept on happening that way, trying to find a partner, but never being able to get that relationship past 4 or 6 weeks. You know, why? And of course, the answer was obvious to a monk. Your elder sister's got a husband she doesn't want. You want one. Your sister's share. But that's actually where, you know, we started talking about, if you're married, you had, say, just talking about a woman, you have married woman suffering. It's all the same, everyone has that. Don't think that, you know, something wrong with your relationship. You know, it's never sort of like nirvana, being married. So, you know, this married person suffering. And if you get divorced and separated, you have single woman suffering. So don't think you can get out of suffering by sort of changing your marital status. You just exchange one type of dukkha for another type of dukkha. And so then people think, okay, then I'll become a nun. And it's true, once you become a nun, you haven't got married woman suffering, nor you've got single woman suffering anymore. You've got nun suffering. And I remember this as a young monk. You know, when I was young, I was really thin. Honestly, you've seen some photographs of me, really thin. You were the end of the line, and all these big monks like Ajahn Chah, they'd always get the first choice of the food. And, you know, I'd get just, you know, the leftovers, basically. And so I looked at Ajahn Chah, look, he's enlightened. He doesn't need delicious food. And I'm at the end of the line there. I still got my defilements. I'm the one who needs, as a young monk, a young novice, I'm the one who needs the food. And so I'd appreciate it, not the other stuff. And we would never have any cushions. The biggest cushions were for the senior monks. Junior monks would just sit on the concrete. And I was all skin and bones. I needed those cushions, not Ajahn Chah. You know, he had lots of upholstery. As I kept on thinking like that, that it was like you had junior monk suffering. And now, you know, I do all the work and doing this and doing that, washing robes for Ajahn Chah and working and stuff. And now I'm senior monk. I don't have to just, I get the first choice of the food. I get nice big cushions, you know, inherent ones and ones underneath me. People take me around. And now, so, but now, I've got senior monk suffering. And sometimes I look at those monks and see that they don't have to give a talk or answer questions. They're over in the monastery just meditating nice and quietly. They don't have so much responsibilities and duties. So you can see, no matter where you are in samsara, you only flip one type of suffering for another type of suffering. So you are rich. You've got rich person suffering. You're poor. You get poor person suffering. Don't think that once I win the lottery, then I'll be happy. You just change one form of suffering for another form of suffering, that's all. So that is why you have fantasies having a partner. I don't know who's writing this. I hope it wasn't one of the nuns. There's one missing, so... But what it was is, yeah, imagination, but imagination. In imagination, the fantasy, you're always the hero, you always win. And it comes in the end that you end just like in the movies. You just go off into the sunset with your partner and live happily ever after. But you know, when you say, come on, really? And you find life is not like that. I wanted something today after I happened to see your fully filled interview slots and wondered if I should come see you. Wondered about it for a day before I realized actually coming to see you is probably just to let you validate my past day's experience and to answer the question which probably I already have an answer to. It deep in my heart. It's more about validating my ego and pride, and that's when I caught myself. So why did you write the question down then? Was the writing the question down to validate your ego? You can't win, can you? But no, I want to see, that's fine. But questions. There was a wonderful time when you answer questions. It's important I try and answer the questions. And if I don't answer the questions properly, that sometimes I feel, in a sense, it's disrespectful to you. So I always feel that because sometimes I ask the question and people just didn't take it seriously or they didn't really understand it. And that is just disrespectful. I try my best. Sometimes I don't understand the question, miss the mark, I have too many, which means they can't get through everyone, but I try my best. But when I had questions, I was visiting this monk, Ajahn Tate, one of those great experiences which I just treasure and share with as many people as possible. This was a great monk, enlightened for sure, as far as I was concerned. But so when I finally got to see him and have a personal interview, it took a long time to get to see him. When I went in there, I had all my questions. I knew this is the only time I probably ever have to answer these really deep questions of a really great monk. And what did that happen? As soon as I got into his presence, no questions. They all evaporated. It wasn't fear. I wasn't afraid of answering them. There was just, they never made any sense. And it was just his incredible kindness and peace. You felt totally accepted. His door of his heart was totally open to me. Who needs any questions? Nothing was missing. You don't need to answer every question in life. You just need to feel peace. I mean, it's so peaceful and still, there weren't any questions. It's a wonderful experience of how to really answer questions. These questions I answer here, we notice every day there's more questions in the box in the evening. So, am I succeeding in giving you answers? If I was, there'd be less questions. But sometimes with the kindness, you feel no questions needed. You don't need to improve yourself. You don't need to actually this inquiring mind. It's a bit of a restless mind. When you find peace, you've got the answers. Who needs any questions? Anyway, Thanks for pointing out to pay attention on my bodily pains and set up the griefometer. I didn't realize that my aching body was due to grief. Yeah. I thought I was just getting older. Every 2 weeks I had a problem to wake up because of vertigo. I felt my head was spinning. Today I gave so much care to my body. I meditated on Bodhinyana, mainly on body awareness. It was really peaceful and feel free. 2 hours passed easily without much thoughts, especially thoughts of responsibility and of family dramas. It felt good. Thank you. It's excellent. Sometimes you do innovate. Now, griefometer, where do you find that in the suttas? So please don't ask me, what's the word in Pali for griefometer, and in what sutta can you find it? It's just an innovation, it's just taking it further, it's not going against the teaching of the Buddha. It's like finding out just how we can get a better way of being aware of our body, being aware of our mind, and discovering how it all works. So it's wonderful. Dear Ajahn, did the Buddha meditate after enlightenment? And if so, why? Just for the pleasure? Once you've finished the work on your computer, does your computer just turn off? It's called the default state. So for a Buddha, meditation was a default state. What the Buddha did. It's just what happened when the Buddha wasn't doing anything. Default was the jhanas, the meditating. Because meditation is not what you do. It's what happens when you stop doing. And that's what Ajahn Chah kept on saying, the leaf on a tree, it only moves because of the wind. Because you want something. And imagine, what does the Buddha want? Yeah, you know, if it's somebody asks him a question, and so that agitates his leaf, and into teaching, and looking after the Sangha and stuff. But then, just when there's nothing to do, no wanting, the leaf becomes perfectly still. But the word these days is default state. So when there's nothing to do, jhanas. It just happens. You don't go into those places, you have to take yourself out again. And the good simile is the bird roosting on a tree at night. Somebody told me this and I thought this is such a cool simile. Because I sort of wondered why after a heavy storm you don't see all the birds on the bottom of the tree falling off. And sometimes, have you ever fallen out of bed? You know, and you're tossing and turning. And this is like high on a tree and they've only got a tiny little place to actually to stand on. But those birds, they stay up there all night, perfectly safe. And the ornithologist said the reason is that the birds' claws, when they relax, when they let go, the default state is they close up. The more relaxed, the more they let go, the more their claws close and they grip into the wood. And it takes effort in the morning to actually to strive to open up those claws so they can fly off. So the default state, when they're not doing anything else, when they let go, it's just really stable. The more they let go, the more stability they have. The more it closes up. That's just like a Buddha. When you let go, just totally still. It's not what you do, it's you have to do something to go out there and teach. Ajahn Brahm, after listening to your morning talk, I had some great meditation. Wonderful. My energy level went up from 2 to 3 out of 10 in the morning, from 2 to 3 out of 10 in the morning to 10 out of 10 by the afternoon. Woohoo! Unfortunately, my mind became very restless and I could not sit still again. How should one calm the mind after getting too much energy? If too much energy is not too much energy. In the jhana states, it's just incredibly high energy. And afterwards, I mentioned to a few people, I think in public, that you can't sleep at night. You don't want to sleep at night. There's no need to sleep. Because your mind has been energized. It's been recharged. But high energy is like someone giving you a Bugatti car with I don't know how many horsepower. Or like a, I say Bugatti because Mamudu, he was really into cars when he was a layperson. And so he showed me, no, actually I saw it on the news feed, the ABC News. I said, look at this, this is a Bugatti. It cost about $50 million or something. There's only about six of them. And it's got. And you go, wow, can I get one of those for Albany? He said, no. He never said that, but I was teasing him. But if you do have like a Ferrari, a fast car, you have to have skills to be able to drive it. And this is the same, you have high energy. So you have to be very skillful to be able to handle the high energy of a powerful mind. And so you learn those skills. You get powerful limiters. You don't sort of try and sort of steer it. You just learn to go with it, to become one with those great waves, you know, just on these surfing competitions, to be able to steer it, but not with force. You just learn to understand it and just go with it. And this is actually the great energies of deep meditation. Huge energies, but they're not dangerous. You just got to learn how to handle the great energies of 10 out of 10 energy. You don't need to be restless. Get your wisdom going and your kindness, beautiful energy, and just, oh, you, to the limiters, and go in this jhana, and oh, yeah. So, vroom, off you go. The phrase, this is the path without growing, if I'm not wrong, it can be found in the Samanyapada Sutta, Sutta number 2 or 3 of the Digha Nikaya. Excellent. So, there we go. Answer to this is a very good example. I don't go in there and look it up. I don't put any effort in there. The answer just comes to me. So isn't it great? You know, you have big questions like that. You just leave it out there. And then just you meditate and just do whatever you need to do. And then suddenly the answer comes in the question box. This is the great thing about no effort. Someone else does it. I felt peaceful during parts of meditation. Later on, I started to feel quite restless with a lot of random thoughts. I tried to be kind and let it be. During one meditation, I felt very anxious, like someone might hurt me. Physically, I felt myself tearing up and startled awake. Is that okay? Why did this happen? Thank you. You find out why it happened. Don't ask me. So, you were peaceful during parts of the meditation, and then you started to feel quite restless. Why? Find out, where did that restless come? Were you wanting that peace to go deeper? Quite likely, it's wanting usually causes restless. And the random thoughts, once you start shaking the bottle, then there's waves. I try to be kind and let it be. Don't try to be kind, just be kind. Let it be. During one meditation, I felt very anxious, like someone might hurt me. Sometimes that might be something from something triggering a memory of a trauma or an anxiety, but you can open your eyes when that happened, and there's no one ever hurts anybody here. This is one of the safest places in the world, and people are just so kind, they keep precepts here, and you don't get any sort of people getting into this place who shouldn't be here. So, they hurt you physically, no one will hurt you physically here. You're perfectly safe in this place. Even the kangaroos and the snakes and the other things, they don't hurt anybody. So if even a snake doesn't hurt anybody, you know, who would hurt any of you? You find yourself tearing up and startled awake. Or tearing up, just you let it be. And just gather the data, just don't interfere with it. That's the most important thing in the whole world. You know, you feel that someone's going to hurt you. Care for that feeling. Don't try and get rid of it. Don't react to it. It's right in front of you, the most important thing in the whole world. Care for it. And let it teach you its secrets. So is that okay? Yeah, everything's okay. Why do we ask guests to turn their mobile phones to silent mode for 1 hour talk? the Dhammaloka, but not for a 9-day noble silence retreat at Jhana Grove. Sorry, not meaning to be cheeky, but I don't understand. Again, it's much of the deeper teachings of meditation. It takes many years to understand. So don't think that you understand on one retreat. Turn the mobile phones to silent mode for 1 hour talk at Dhammaloka, but there's already lots of noise. People come in and go out of the room, and then there's cars outside, and there's the sirens of the police cars outside, and there's all sorts of things happening over there. But if you can, wonderful. We say we do ask over there, but people still don't do it. You know why? They forget. They make mistakes. And sometimes one of the reasons I don't ask people to do this, because I want people to also understand how to deal with mistakes and disturbances. It's no one's fault. No one does it on purpose, leaving their mobile phone on so it makes a noise. But it's a mistake, an accident, unintended. Can you embrace and make peace with the unintended? Or do you want to control and make sure that when people come in here, everybody has their mobile phones examined to make sure everything is off? So anyway, if you can turn it off, wonderful, why not? Put it in flight mode or jhana mode is even a better mode. Anyway, thank you for your simple but profound teachings these last few days. I have made more progress here than in the last few years. Oh, crikey. Is that a good thing, making progress? Comparing? Anyway, wait and see. Reading your book is nowhere near to listening to your talks live. Thank you also for building Jhana Grove, a truly wonderful place for meditation. You know, one of the reasons why live is more effective than seeing something on a screen, again, is much more gets transmitted, you know, from eye to eye, you know, face to face, than on a screen. And it's one of the reasons why I always thought, well, why can't I just record these retreats, like Goenka did, and then I can go off in my cave and leave you all to it. And now, as the monk yesterday, Venerable Buddha saying, no, he's heard all the jokes and the stories so many times, so why don't I just say them once, all the stories, all the jokes, all the advice, say it once, and video it, and then I won't need to do it anymore. I'll be able to relax to the max in my cave. But I realize it doesn't work. Because there is something happens when it's face to face. And I understand that's one of the reasons why when your children or anybody tries to speak to each other screen to screen, it's not the same as just talking in front of someone, conversing together. So sending SMSs just doesn't cut it. Even just video conferences, it's not the same as actually being in the same room and talking. Unfortunately, I wish it was the case, but it's not. So this is a nice place for meditation, but it's the place. It won't be a good place for meditation. It hasn't got the people who make it a nice place. In Mahayana tradition, there is the pure land heaven where people can meditate and develop true understanding of Dhamma under Maitreya Amitabha Buddha. Jhana Grove must be the pure land on earth. Yes! So you don't need to give donations to big fancy temples so you get reborn in the pure land. You don't need to chant Amitofu. You're here! You did that in your past life. Now, you've managed to get to the pure land, it's here. So, you don't need to do that anymore. When I said that, a lot of people got very upset at me over in Singapore and other places.
Thanks again to Venerable Muni for excellent guided meditation. Wow, you've got an extra syllable now. You were Mu yesterday, now Muni, and now tomorrow Munis. All right. Anyway, joy at the start technique really helped me a lot. Excellent. This time the voice heard at the back very well, very clear. Thanks to Christina for a new microphone setup. Yeah, sometimes, I think it was a TV program called The Voice. Never seen it, but... So you've got The Voice? So that's where actually we do the teachings, and you don't know what monk or nun is actually giving the talk. And you can find The Voice to see which... Would that work? I make these things as I go along, I don't know. What is a voice anyway? Is it some... They don't know what a person looks like. So they're singing. I mean, they're not giving Dhamma talks or telling jokes. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So, in other words, they turned around and they got a recording device on it so they can actually play, so they can play whatever sound. And so that they're lip syncing. Not lip syncing. Okay. So what we should do, we should actually turn all the nuns around. And if they give a good talk, you like the voice, then we could employ them. Okay, anyway, come on, let's get going. Can meditation help someone with mental illness? It depends what type of mental illness, and it can help many people with mental illness. And this is, you've got to get the right type of meditation for the right person in the right state. And that's why we say in Buddhism that everyone has got mental illness unless you're a perfect enlightened arahat. If you're totally enlightened, then you're not mentally ill. So this is Jhana Grove Institution for the mentally challenged. But you're talking about some severe mental illness, and of course it really depends, and more people are just finding some of these techniques to be highly useful in overcoming the mental illnesses, you know, such as schizophrenia, such as ODD, some as OCD, ACDC. Apparently that's a rock band somewhere. Actually they were in Perth apparently. And a lot of my monks sort of know that band. And so every now and again you hear them saying, it's one of their songs, it's a long way to the shop to get a sausage roll. Those of you who know ACDC, I think it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. But actually what they say is a long way to the shop if you want a sausage roll. Oh, okay, a spring roll. Okay, you know a spring roll much better. It's a long way to the shop if you want a spring roll. Anyway. It can, but it needs a lot of skill to help someone with a mental illness. But it can be done. And sometimes, you know, what is mental illness is every type of... I actually gave a talk the other day at Nolamara Temple, Dhammaloka, on autism and autism spectrum. And you know, it went down very well. Just how you can use some of the wisdom and the techniques of Buddhism to ameliorate the symptoms. I like the word help someone with mental illness, not cure them. You try and cure them, that's the problem. Caring for them. How is the mind of a meditator experiencing new perceptions different from a mentally ill patient experience episode of hallucinations? It's the usually the difference is a meditator is socially integrated. In other words, whatever their hallucinations or stuff are, they are not something which takes away just their ability to converse with other people, be with other people, and their ability to survive in this world. So it's not sort of harmful. But anyway, that's a big question. Does the four Brahma Viharas differ in quality? For example, upeka contentment is the best quality. Upeka contentment is the best quality and more sublime than the other three. And also the compassion is more sublime than loving kindness. Please come and thank you. I think that just as loving kindness, it depends much more on just the quality you imbue them with than their inherent superiority. If someone is really into metta, that's, you know, excellent. And that's all one needs. But anyway, I don't think the one is better than the other. Where does fear fit into the hindrances, please? Why is it not a bigger topic in the Dhamma, given the problems it causes us humans? Thanks very much. Because, again, there's two types of fear, and there's like the fear which is, you know, does protect you from the boiling water or the flame. It's a fear which has a purpose to it. But there's a fear which is sometimes just, it's got no real purpose to it as well, at all. And a lot of that fear is, you know, the fear what other people say about us. The fear of not being able to fit in. The fear which stops some people when they feel like they've got tears coming in their eyes, they suppress it and they won't cry in this hall. Or they won't laugh in this hall because they're afraid of disturbing others. That may be a bit better because crying doesn't actually create so much noise, but laughing does. Now, what is it, the fear that stops people performing? It's always a fear of letting go. And sometimes, where does that fear fit in? I would actually say it's almost part of restlessness, because the restlessness also has this part called remorse. I never actually said that. It's Dosantorpa, but it's restlessness and remorse. And sometimes that remorse has a lot of fear involved into it. So, a bigger topic in the Dharma, given the problems it causes us humans, you can actually sometimes see, we haven't got it here, that image of the Buddha, where he's, sometimes as some people think, oh, that's the policeman Buddha. He's got his hand up there, like in a sort of, and it's the, it is the fearless, the Abhaya Mudra. He's saying you don't need to be afraid. And that sort of fearlessness is actually, has actually got its way into one of the mudras of a Buddha statue. But of course, you know, fear is not in the hindrances, but I suppose it will come in when you're afraid, there'll be some ill will, some restlessness, and obviously some wanting. So it's a more secondary hindrance, secondary problem. But it's also, you see it coming in the decision making which we make, because the Buddha always said, if you have to make a decision in life, check out the four, what he called agati, the four things never to follow. And that is like selfish desire, ill will, stupidity, and fear. So if you want to become a monk, or if you want to sort of do something different, you want to come to a retreat, when you make decisions, you never make decisions, changing of career or whatever, you never make decisions based on those four, and especially out of fear. So you make a decision, you're going to come here. What other people say about you, you want to become a monk, what other people think of you, fear should not be something which determines your decision making. Anyway, I've got a few left, I'm getting a bit tired, but here we go. So the lady who experienced NDE, near-death experience on the operating table, was told to go back to life by some being. Who could that being be? And from where? I heard from Charlie saying that there will be something, the administrator from the death realm, sorry, not sure about the correct terms, to grab people whose life reaches the appointed date so to say, but that's not supposition. That's not supposed. Superstition is real. Thank you, wish you a good enough rest and sleep if you wish. There is, it's a shame Nibbuta wasn't here because he told this really cool story from his village. Now, first of all, this was in the Punjab. And first of all, it does seem to be that in the Punjab, in the Sikh religion, all the guys got the surname Singh, and all of the women had the surname Kaur. So it's always Mr. Singh and Mrs. Kaur. And they have obviously another name, but because one half of their name is always the same, the odds that two people of the same name get even more probable. So what happened? One of his cousins or his auntie died in the village in the morning. She's pronounced dead. And so in their tradition, they were arranging the funeral that evening, get everybody from the village, get the pile of wood, get the priest, whatever it was. But then late in the afternoon, she revived. And this was not years and years ago. This was not that long ago in Venerable Nibbuta's memory. So that, you know, the proper doctor declared her dead, and then she came to again. But the story she told was the interesting part. She said when she died, these two beings, they dragged her away to see this boss spirit. When the boss spirit saw her coming, the boss spirit scolded the two lesser spirits. So you've got the wrong Mrs. Singh, stupid. You know, she's not the wrong Mrs. Kaur. This is not the right Mrs. Kaur. There's another Mrs. Kaur in the same village, the same name. Take her back. So they took her back, and that's when she woke up. And after she woke up, another Mrs. Kaur in the same village with the same other name, she died. So this time they got the right one. So be careful if you have names which are too similar, like Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Brahmali. Mistakes do happen. So anyway, that's what they actually said. It was really funny. Dear Venerable Muni, your introduction in meditation talk is excellent. Guided meditation needs a bit more volume, please. That's from yesterday, I think. Anyway, excellent. More praise. Thank you for the great talk this morning. After your talk, I sat down and had my best meditation today. And what do I say? Another satisfied customer. Hang on, it says, thank you, Moo, for the... I think you said, thank you, Moo, for the MOO-VING guided meditation. The moving meditation. Oh, crikey. And the last one. In meditation, if there is no teacher or anyone to guide us, what measurement of what indication can we use for us to know or be confident we are on the right path to jhana or deeper states? Have you read that book, No Ajahn Chah? There is no Ajahn Chah. So you don't have a teacher. There's no Ajahn Brahm. There's no Munisara. Do you have a teacher? Do you? So in the end, what measurement, what indication can we use for us to know to be confident we are on the right path? I think this is good to say this story. Now, this was, how do you know you're going in the right direction or not? There are so many different teachers, so many different teachings of even one teacher. There's so many different traditions. And many traditions, they all say they're the best. Do you know any teacher who ever says they're the worst? They don't do that, do they? So instead, they say, that follow me. And sometimes if I say, no, don't follow me, I'm a very bad teacher, they say, I never heard any teacher say that. That must be very profound. I must follow that teacher. So you can't win. So anyway, you just teach. But how do you know you're getting good teachings? And even if you get good teachings, how do you know that you're understanding them and following them properly? So, you know, that sometimes any teacher can say something, and do you really understand what they mean you to say? So you can follow it properly. So what happens is that we get confused. And it's called a hindrance of doubt. And the best simile I've come up with to overcome and understand how to overcome doubt was this simile when I was a student and I used to spend many of my summer vacations in Scotland in the Highlands, you know, north of Fort William. I think it was Fort William, yeah. You know, way up, you know, in the northern part of Scotland. And I was staying at a hostel one day, and the hostel warden, who was, you know, from that area, invited me to go for a nice walk up one of the mountains. It was a beautiful summer's day, clear, there's no clouds anywhere to be seen in the sky. It's not really hot in that far north, but it was a nice little trek, you know, we took some, I think, oranges or sandwiches or something, and up we went to the top of the mountain, sat down, saw the great view, and just had a rest, had a chat, no rush, taking our time. And then there was another mountain not far away, and I said, I'd like to go up that one as well. He said, no, one mountain's enough for me. So he went back, and I carried on by myself, alone, which you should never do in wilderness areas. And I sometimes just scold the hostel manager for letting me do that. So off I went to the next mountain, and the nature of the climate over there, it changes in a flash. The clouds came over from the Atlantic Ocean, the North Atlantic, so quickly, and I was just getting to the top of the mountain, the clouds came over and they descended, and I was enveloped in mist. And I knew enough about that area, that mist could last for days. And I couldn't see, my hand at the end, I could hardly see it. So I thought, no trouble at all, I've got a good sense of direction. So we all think. But then I started walking, and just I couldn't see very far, but I thought this was the way I came. Later found out, amazing, it was 180 degrees opposite to where I thought I was going. I couldn't have gone more in an opposite direction, because I was walking and I came this close to the edge of a cliff. And I could see because, you know, the mist, it wasn't that thick, and I looked down and it was a long way down. And I was really scared, because if I were a little bit more mindless, I would have trepped over and that would be the end of me. And I really, really dead, no injury, it's a long way down. And afterwards, when I looked on the Ordnance Survey maps of the area, that's where I found there's only one cliff that dangerous, that steep, and that was in the opposite direction I thought I was going. So, you're in trouble, life-threatening. What do you do? So fortunately, I've always never actually been sort of an anxious person, not really scared, and just, okay, calm down, what should you do? And what came up in my mind was just basic science. Water always flows downhill. So, I decided to find a little creek and follow it. And my determination, whichever way that creek went, it sort of meandered this way and that way. If I thought it was in the wrong direction, no, I'm going to follow that creek 100%. So I walked down past, along the creek, another little brook came into it. It got a bit bigger, and then following it and following it and following it, another brook came in. It was a bigger little stream, kept on following it and following it and following it, because every time I followed it, I was descending from the mountain, getting lower and lower and lower. Until, you know, it's quite a decent sized stream by this time, it got so low I was underneath the mist. And then I could see my directions. It was clear again, because the mist only goes to the top of the mountains, and you go low enough, and then you're below the clouds, and you can see where you're going. And that's how I escape. And to me, that is the answer to this question. How do you know which way to meditate, what to do? Because people say all sorts of different things. So, you follow a stream, which leads to more peace, more calm, more happiness, more relaxation, more joy, more mindfulness, more kindness. These are good qualities which you know, are part of the path. And as they grow, you must be going in the right direction. So you keep on following that peace, that stillness, that kindness, that joy, that relaxation, that health, the lack of getting upset at other people, more resilience, more kindness, more selflessness, and a whole list of values. If those are increasing, as it says in the Siddha, wholesome things are getting bigger, are getting stronger. It means you're going in the right direction. You follow that stream, and it winds this way and that way and this way, and you get to the time, the moment, when you're below the mist, streaming. You can see where everything fits together. You're under the mist, and you can actually see it as the way for the rest of the path. And it's clear, because there's no mist anymore. You've wound your way underneath the mist. So that is actually a wonderful way of overcoming the hindrance of doubt, making sure you're going in the correct direction. And if you can't judge that, ask the people you live with. And quite frankly, if you go back home after this retreat, and your wife, your partner, your even dog, indicates to you you're more a pain in the butt than you were when you left, then you're going in the wrong direction. If you're happier, more peaceful, more kind, more generous, there's more holy, if you like, then you're going in the right direction. That's how you find out. And that is based, an elaboration on the story of the Buddha's advice to Upali, and also he repeated that, the Buddha's advice to Mahaprajapati. So whatever dharma, whatever path leads to those great qualities, you can know that as being the teachings of a Buddha, that is the dharma of a Buddha. You know it because it leads in those directions. So, there we go. Emptiness. Sadhu. 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 So have a wonderful night tonight, and please, try and check. If you bring in your mobile phones, devices to record talks and stuff, please make sure that it's on that, the airplane mode or whatever it's called, so it doesn't make any noises.